Recently stumbled across the theme tune to a 70s sitcom called Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads. It aired on the BBC for two series between 1973 and 1974 and was itself a sequel to the earlier 60s sitcom just called The Likely Lads, both written by Ian Lafreniere and Dick Clement. And I remember it repeating all of the time when I was a kid. I'd see it in the background on the television and stuff, but I didn't pay that much attention to it. But both are set in my hometown, or both series anyway, are set in my hometown of Newcastle and its surrounding area. But before we go on, let's have a quick dive into the lore of the Likely Lads. The first series in the 60s was a knockabout affair of two young lads getting up to mischief and dating girls and going out to pubs and so on. The two main characters are called Bob Ferris and Terry Collier. At the end of the first series in the 60s, the lads decide to join the army, but Bob is pulled off the truck taking them because he's got flat feet, which was he would get you kicked out of the army back in the day. I don't know about now. But this means that Terry, who never really wanted to join the army in the first place, goes in for 5 years. And whatever happened to the Likely Lads, we catch up with them 5 years later on a train travelling at night, which conveniently goes dark, so they don't know they're in the same carriage. Bob tells the stranger who he's in there with the hilarious story about how his mate ended up in the army by accident, and it's Terry, of course, who calls him a bastard straight away. So it's the first big joke. But what I found fascinating watching some of the episodes was the change in tone and style. I originally became reminded of the series hearing its theme tune play in my neighbour's garage, who must have switched from absolute 80s to 70s for a change. The theme tune sets the tone for what's to come, which is a bittersweet and sometimes dark comedy of lost youth and a nostalgia for a northeast which was rapidly changing at that time. Terry, now released from the army, is jobless and single, though he claims to have had a German wife at some point. And Bob is doing very well. He's engaged to Thelma, who's a bit of a ball breaker, and that's part of the joke. But he's just bought a house in one of the new and rising housing estates that were back then, just popping up across North Tyneside. And so what the main narrative is infused with is a certain pathos or melancholy, and a bit of tension too. Terry laments that he's lost out on all of the parties and free love of the late 60s, as well as seeing all of his favourite haunts being demolished, and especially the rise of the brutalist architecture that seemed to cover the northeast in the early 70s, going up until about the 90s. Bob, on the other hand, is upwardly mobile and has aspirations to become bourgeois. He's taken to tennis and pretends to like art. And in all fairness, his point that Newcastle of the old days was a grime-ridden slum holds a lot of truth to it. And so these themes are what drive Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads, a mixture of nostalgia, dislocation and change. People may be surprised at the date here. After all, this is years before Margaret Thatcher came to power, and she's usually charged with the decline of the North East. In actual fact, the heavy industry which powered the North had been in decline for decades before Thatcher came to power. In a sense, Thatcher just formalised the process which was taking place anyway. The backdrop to whatever happened to the Knightley lads, the terraced housing of North Tyneside being demolished because, as Bob says, they weren't fit for purpose. But Terry's identity and very soul seemed to be bound up in those streets and that life.
Woburn Abbey. You think the houses we lived in as kids, if you sneezed, they said, bless you next door.
No, but them houses had some character about them. There's just something depressing about these estates. Just the thought of you all getting up at the same time, all eating the same sort of low-calorie breakfast cereal, all coming home at 6:30, switching on the same programme at the same time and having it off the same two nights of the week.
Bob's new build on the new suburbia is at Killingworth's Highfields estate, but less than 1 mile away, construction was underway to house the people from Terry's world, the terraces, in what would become Killingworth's notorious and dystopian garths. Terry points out that he dislikes this new age of the central planner and social engineer. At the same time, he also rails against the soul-crushing wage slavery of the new suburbia.
To make way for the new underpass.
So the ordinary working man doesn't come into it. It's all down to town planners and environments and landscapers, and people like me are just bulldozed aside in the name of progress.
In this regard, Terry, everyone's favourite character and the driver of the whole show, is actually quite reactionary. But at the same time, it's worth considering that whatever happened is itself a relic of British culture. After all, it's nigh on 50 years old. Here we have a somewhat forgotten comedy slash drama from nearly 50 years ago, which was itself saturated in a backwards looking lament, a nostalgia for a place that had been but wasn't anymore, and a way of life and entire existence which was dying out. In my view, the two men in the show represent archetypes that have recurred across the decades. It was Terry who was to bear the brunt of the social change, or at least his type. It was Bob who'd find his place in the changing Britain. Terry would be destined either to remain on the terraced housing rows and eventually be met with diversity and multiculturalism, Newcastle's surrounding sprawl. Bob would live out his life in suburbia and on the golf course. Terry would end up in the high-rise hell of the social housing departments and line up at the door. Bob would be holidaying in Malta. It's fun to laugh at the boring conformity of Bob's pride in his Ford Escort and new build, and that his kids would probably emerge to be the socially liberal petit bourgeois snobs destined to become the backbone of the progressive left in Britain. But Terry's wholesome working class moralising was about to be met with something much worse. Complete spiritual collapse, crime and drug use has happened all across the Tyneside Council estates in the years after Big Industry.
The regional news. There have been more disturbances on Tyneside, this time in the west end of Newcastle, 10 miles from the scene of Monday night's riots on the Meadowell estate in North Shields. Derelict houses, a pub and cars were set on fire, firemen were stoned and fire engines damaged. And youths in a stolen car added to the chaos, doing stunts in front of burning buildings. Malcolm Herdman's been on the streets of Tyneside.
Trouble flared as darkness fell in the west end of Newcastle and crowds of youths gathered on the city's Elswick Road. A van was overturned in the middle of the road and set alight as a blaze took hold of a boarded-up pub nearby. Firemen who arrived to put out the blaze were beaten back by a crowd of around 300 youths. Many of them stood and watched as a pair of joyriders wearing ski masks arrived at the scene and performed a display of so-called hotting, doing handbrake turns in the middle of the road. Some of the bystanders continued to throw rocks and stones at the speeding vehicle as it swerved backwards and forwards, narrowly missing some members of the crowd.
After decades of neglect, it would be Terry's side of this equation that would see New Hope and New Labour and vote for Tony Blair. And we all know how that story ended. Many people pulled their hair out over why the North continued to vote Labour and how entrenched Labour had become in areas like North Tyneside. But the real tragedy is that they were doing so on a premise of opposing social change. From the perspective of Terry, the Tories were more radically social than Labour because free market capitalism had a habit of dismantling communities. But all these old arguments are redundant now. After all, Bob did okay out of it, as did his own family. the counter-argument of stagnation, it does have merit. There's a bit of a contradiction in Terry's worldview as well. On the one hand, he yearns for a sense of place and belonging, but on the other hand, he's angry that he missed out on the free love fest of the late 60s because he was in the army. Really, Terry wants to have his cake and eat it, and he wants the traditional life of the working-class Geordie, but he also wants to enjoy the socially liberal values that are undermining it. It's interesting that the very first time we're introduced to both men, that they're sitting in a sleazy strip club. The reason Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads was so popular is that Ian Lafrenier and Dick Clement, the writers, weren't really taking a side. There isn't much politics in it. I mean, just compare that with another comedy archetype of that era, Alf Garnett. Garnett is a weather vane for what would to come. Garnett would probably hold similar views to Terry, but the difference is the framing and presentation. Garnett is somebody to be laughed at because of his bigotry and petty-mindedness. It allows the audience to wince but feel good about themselves, that they aren't like that. They're better. It caters more to Bob sitting on his suburban semi. On the other hand, we've all been Terry. We can sympathise down the pub, where you took a girlfriend is now gone completely and become a Tesco's car park. It isn't the job of Clement and Frenier to demonise or lecture or slip in political messaging. What they're doing is what good storytellers do. They tell you what you already know. In the actual lived life of Geordies in the 70s, everyone would have felt or understood the themes being explored in The Likely Lads. They would have known people just like Terry and Bob, and straight away there's a tendency to descend into politics or criticism. But what's really happening is the revealing of a state of being, a presentation of a situation that people went through, and the use of narrative to contextualise it. In the end, it doesn't matter whether you're a free market type or an old school Labour type lamenting the end of industry. What the writers are doing is depicting a story we all went through collectively, a shared story. As an aside, Alf Garnett actively invites the audience to take a side and sets a trap for those sympathetic to Alf. But Alf's writers have a different agenda. A healthy folk memory, as depicted in Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads, allows us, the people, to see beyond the merely political and embrace a collective experience. It is something that we can relate to because we went through it. And I know what many people write in the comments. They don't make them like that anymore. And they don't. It's a 50-year-old show. The difference is, of course, that now what should have been media to explore folk memory and our collective experience is just a tool of politics. And we all feel it. We all know it. And those with brains feel alienated from it. Ian Lafrenier and Dick Clement drew from the real world, from chats in pubs and football stands, from the experience of the lived life. They then fictionalised it and presented it, and the audience found catharsis and recognition in it, as well as the characters they felt they knew. It wasn't ideological, but today all culture is. And so what we get today, which is nigh on unwatchable, does not come from ideas of like people sitting talking in a pub, but from the think tank and academic and the social science department. For these people, the Terrys of England would have become a severe problem and a headache. After all, they could hardly draw on what was being honestly discussed in pubs for TV content when they mainly deemed it a hate crime. The folk memory was not something to be expressed using technology, but something invented and crafted. How could it be any other way? Political correctness was as alien to common folk as the newly arriving demographic components of the new thinking, the new politics, the new identity. Using a cultural form to represent what people were thinking and thereby offering a form of self-recognition and catharsis couldn't be done if the aims of the political and media classes were so drastically at odds with the identity of the people. And so instead of expressing how people were thinking, they were told what to think. The actual real folk memory was to be treated the same way the planners in Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads treat Eric's Fish and Chip Shop or the Fat Ox.
In pictures.
Well, at least Eric still survived.
Just.
And what they'd replace it with was as cold and inhuman as the brutalist architecture of Gateshead and Killamuff. Another series set in the northeast called Our Friends in the North explores at great length the political and economic horse trading behind some of the social upheaval in the northeast, the petty corruption and contempt that spanned decades. Now, a more in-depth dive into Our Friends will have to wait for another day, but for now it's interesting to ponder how that would be covered today. Our Friends' story ended in the mid-90s, but how could such a drama today look back on the previous decades and accurately express what the people had gone through collectively? It simply couldn't be done without unravelling and undermining their own priors, which were and are inorganic and dictated, not representing the folk memory or lived life. The brutalist architecture Terry rails against was never supposed to be what it became. In the design stages, it represented something aloft, above the ground, future-looking and confident dwellings for the post-war era. In the abstract, it worked. The theory seemed sound. The problem was they hadn't considered the human condition, how people actually are. Today's ideological constructs have the same issues, but unlike brutalism, they're much more difficult to tear down. It's easy to have a pop at brutalism these days, but if we're to answer the question, so whatever did happen to the Likely Lads, the answer probably isn't to be found in the now demolished brutalism, but on the housing estates of Bob's suburbia, as Terry explains.
I haven't had a chance to personalise it yet. Once everybody moves in and does their own decorating and choosing all the curtains and that. Got a flair for that kind of thing, as Thelma. We're having mauve and seaweed green.
At least that's unusual.
We were going to have yellow, but they're having that next door.
Ah, well, that's it. I mean, that's me point, isn't it? You've said it all. It just seems sad to me when you realise that the only way people can tell the difference between you and anybody else is by the colour of your curtains.
The life of the atomised, conforming consumer whose time has been calculated and commodified, existing on a sprawl of Barrett bills, doesn't lend itself to a common folk memory or identity. In fact, it dissolves it. And what replaces it is the messaging of the television, the crafted narratives, the top-down culture. In the end, anyone who's still sane has become Terry. But what we yearn for is the loss of the collective narrative which we used to live within. We all roll our eyes at the dumb propaganda and synthetic culture of the mainstream which creates our identity for us. We'd like to grumble with friends down the pub, but we'll settle with a bottle of wine in front of Talent Factor and moan there instead. Whatever happened to the Likely Lads is essentially us, 50 years later. But the recognition of the us is the first step to solving the problem. I'll catch you later, folks.